All right, we're in Live World and Scott Isaacs. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
So, you know, just right off the bat, you're the guy who created DHTML.
So
you're credited.
I'm credited with it, so I created all the problems we're faced with today.
Nice job, dude.
Thanks.
And how are you?
Hi there.
Tell people who you are, man. Nice to see you, too.
Dragos Manolescu. I've been on Channel 9 before.
Yes, and, you have.
Good deal. Good job with the interview at JAL with JavaScript and Dave Thomas and Eric Meyer and Pratap. And we'll be tackling that area.
Excellent. Awesome. Cool. So let's jump right into this. What have you been up to? What are you working on these days?
Well, right now I work for Windows Live, but we've been exploring a problem that basically faces all the Web 2.0 type sites out there. How do you solve the mashup security problem?
Yes.
So if you're familiar, if you understand how mashups work, basically you the general models, you include a third-party script on your page. For site developers, they're getting what they want at very low cost. You get maps, takes no effort. But as part of that, they also have to assume that third party is trustworthy, will not violate the privacy policy, and they have to assume that it will keep their site robust and stable. Mm-hmm. So we were working on technology that will basically solve a lot of the Web 2.0 problems that were not addressed in what basically we're still using, which is Web 1.0 technology.
Okay. So what have you done, man?
Well, what we've done is to use a technique that's quite common out there these days, which is virtualization, to improve the security and get some other benefits out of this separation. So we're running the code that typically runs all together in the browser using the shared presentation model and being subject to all the problems that Scott alluded to. We're actually running it in virtual boxes, if you will. This one we call the Web Sandbox. And each of these boxes provides the image of a browser, if you will, for the code running within, without you as a developer having to do anything special. So it's the same philosophy of no new materials in the room. We're securing the Web 2.0 applications without introducing any new APIs, any new gadget SDKs, or any new languages. Mm-hmm. And providing this experience that you're controlling now the way these sandboxed pieces of code communicate with each other.
What's interesting is just to tell a little story. The last time I was on Channel 9 was about 4 or 5 years ago. I lose track of time these days.
Sure.
But we did the Windows Live Web Gadgets. And I was responsible for the architecture underneath those. And it's amazing sometimes how, when you live in your own little isolated world, how you kind of make mistakes you learn about later. Mm-hmm. The Live Gadget programming model involved this fancy little framework that I built that I thought was really cool. You know, everyone wants a web framework these days. And the first gadget that everyone built was and the most common gadget pattern was they created an iframe, pointed out to a web page, and they loaded the web page as their gadget. Now, what's really quite interesting about this is, around the same time, Google introduced gadgets. And I discovered the same gadget that everyone built over there was, we'll create an iframe, go get content. Should have told us something. People like writing HTML pages.
Yes.
They don't need the ability or desire to go leverage these fancy frameworks. So when we were focusing on how do we build a new secure sandbox, the explicit decision was, we're not going to create a framework that people have to program to. We let you just write web pages, and we will take care of making sure they're isolated and secure. So another way to look at this is as kind of a precursor to Web 2.0, next generation web-based gadgets. It's absorbing the benefits and the approaches people want with the programming model that they expect.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about how this is composed, right? I mean, what exactly is the sandbox? You mentioned virtualization. Mm-hmm. Can we get a little bit into the details about what you've made?
What we've done is, first, you can write it, you write an HTML page. That's kind of the default model.
Okay.
A site can decide to configure how much HTML or not supported. But once that's created, basically we have a JavaScript library that will ensure that that code runs in the sandbox. There's a small server component which does nothing more than transform the code so we can keep it in our sandbox. But the reason why I want to say JavaScript library is, the moment we start talking about all these neat things that we want to do in the browser, people get paranoid. They're like, great, another add-on. We're going to have to go install something.
Yeah.
We've designed this, and if we pan to the screen, you'll notice that I basically have every major browser out there. I have Chrome, Firefox, Safari. I forgot to open Opera, and I have IE. In this case, it's IE8 open.
Mm-hmm.
Our virtual sandbox runs in all modern browsers. As is. And that was a very important goal because since we're focusing on a security problem, we don't want users to have to opt in to get security. If we're going to do it, it better work ubiquitously and everywhere.
Absolutely. Very cool.
So from an architecture perspective, yes. You have the runtime, which is provided by the browser, and then we have typically the code runs on top of this runtime, and we are injecting a virtualization layer that handles all the security checks and other goodies that Scott is going to get into in a moment. And the way we're injecting that security, layer is through a code transformation. So we're reading your HTML code, your script code, and the CSS code. We're injecting this layer, intermediate layer in between, and then that is what runs actually in your browser. The layer that we're injecting inside makes call to the runtime, to the JavaScript library that Scott mentioned, and this is where we consolidate runtime, a set of rules or policies that determine whether you can actually access elements of the DOM, you can actually change elements of the DOM, and so on. So that's, from an architectural perspective, at a high level, this is how things work.
So how did you sort of stay out of the way of the security model that's already in place for, say, IE8 and Firefox and Chrome? I mean, they already have their own semantics. And
well, what's interesting is there's this general... There's basically two ways people handle mashup security.
Mm-hmm.
The first and most common is they ignore it. They basically go out there and they... Because they made an explicit decision. There's only, let's say, three partners they'll trust. They'll trust the Microsoft or the Yahoo or the Googles of the world with a script, which will provide mapping functionality. I'll pick the most common one.
Mm-hmm.
They figure they're going to do the right thing by them. Then they're going to go get a hit counter from someone else. They're going to say, well, I know it's just a hit counter. But what's interesting, what's starting to happen in the world, is people are moving beyond what I call these tightly coupled mashups and allowing users to opt in and make decisions. The Facebook gadget model, all of the web portals now have third-party developed gadgets, as I alluded to before, and so on. So we're kind of getting this, and then even more so, sites want to become platforms themselves. They want to provide their own APIs.
Yeah.
So it creates this very interesting dynamic, which is, if you want to be tightly coupled, you ignore it. The other model, which people think is secure, is they basically say, well, iframe the problem. They put everything inside of iframes. Iframes are an isolation mechanism. They're really not true security. Yes, they will keep your personal information safe. They will not let that code touch your personal information. But it doesn't stop that code from going into infinite loops, trying to redirect, trying to install things, trying to do clickjacking. Go read about it. It's a very interesting new little vector that people are using, and so on. So it really comes down to is there's really no effective security model that works. What we've done, and we can kind of show you and give you a, kind of show them more in a picture here, but what we've done is said we're not using iframes. We basically rebuilt our own virtualized security model around the content that people write and put the controls and give the host the controls to manage it.
Okay. Well, let's see some of this then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
I'm going to move the camera and we're going to take a look at it.
I'm going to start in Firefox. We actually just shipped today. This is the week before the PDC. I'm going to start in Firefox. I'll probably rotate browsers if we do a few demos. What I'm starting with is a very simple HTML page. There should be nothing in here that is very interesting or unique to anyone who's written HTML. And I'm going to run it in the sandbox. And you'll notice that we got a page in sandbox. Now, most people look at this and say, that must be an iframe. You drop the page in there.
Mm-hmm.
Due to the fact we're being videoed and you'll have to kind of take my word, I could select through it. That's the easiest way I could show you that it's part of the web page.
Okay.
Now, one thing that was interesting that Drago said is we have this new... here's the original HTML that the user typed. We call that the untrusted input. The server transformation basically turns that code into an executable that will run inside our sandbox. What's interesting about JavaScript and this whole security challenge is that... JavaScript's a dynamic language. You can't do static analysis. There's no way to statically analyze JavaScript for security if you want to support all of JavaScript.
Or even worse, no, you cannot even prove that your program is correct. Not security is
yeah.
an extra.
So all the security work is actually happening at runtime.
Nice.
So just to kind of give you, it's a very subtle example, but we're going to create a second instance where we're just going to swap the colors. And let me make sure I don't typo. But if we did, it wouldn't be a big deal. Obviously, good, perfect. We got now two gadgets on the page. You'll notice that we add another HTML document, and I can select through them. Let me start somewhere where I can actually do a selection. And you'll see, again, no iframe. So the isolation here is that this document is going to get included directly inside another one. The APIs are fully standards-based. IDs don't collide. All those concerns that, I don't know if you think back, like, what is there, Dojo, Prototype, there's dozens of open source libraries out there. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them, I forget which library started it, so I won't guess, but the dollar sign mechanism. It was like the most common API ever invented, and then every library wanted to add it, and they all collided with each other. Part of what we've done with the sandbox is we could actually load multiple versions of all these libraries all side by side on the same web page, and they'll never collide.
Nice.
Which is a really nice piece of functionality because it's solving those real-world problems. How do you aggregate a lot of code and not worry about those collisions? And it doesn't require, and it enforces the pattern. It's not like use those funky namespace patterns that all JavaScript developers learn. No, it just handles it for you.
So, very nice. Yeah, so to be clear, what you see on the screen are actually two instances of the same HTML page that now has been modified. So in one instance, it's white on red, and the other instance is red on white.
Yeah.
The same code, just running two instances in the same HTML page. So that's what the virtualization actually...
You guys are injecting that into the page that gets rendered by the browser.
We're transforming the page into something that you can instantiate and create multiple instances of. So
okay,
Scott could actually clone those if you want to.
So the question, I understand... What I don't understand is exactly... what this virtualization component is and where it resides. So you mentioned you have a small server component,
mm-hmm.
but what's actually, where does this thing live? I'm trying to, can we draw a map? We don't have a whiteboard.
Fortunately, I move offices too much.
You do.
And I didn't get a whiteboard put into this one because I'm
no
moving
worries.
Out.
So let's draw little pictures in our
some
in the
diagrams
air.
In the
you have diagrams anywhere?
Let's go find one for
perfect.
You.
Perfect. Real-time diagram hunting.
Alright, let's go.
All these diagrams are in the documentation, by the way, so
perfect.
Anybody who's interested in...
Should we use that one or the pipeline one?
There we go.
Alright, this explains the server process. Basically, you give us code, whether it's a URL or not, and we go fetch that code. So if, let's say instead of typing HTML in directly, I said, here's my gadget, because the iframe approach, here's my gadget sitting out on the web. We will go fetch that code and do basically an A to B transformation. It simply just turns that code into something that runs against our sandbox.
Okay.
When it reaches the client, basically we have this library. It's the sandbox2.js script. This library, basically, there's a lot of code here. I'm not going to try to read to you. What this library does is virtualizes that execution. So on your web page, you would include this sandbox2.js. Then you would include a reference to the untrusted code being proxied via our server or via client Silverlight component. You could do it either way. So basically, you'd have like script source equals make my code safe.aspx ? Here's the URL.
Okay.
That would load the code. Then the next last step would basically be bind the code to somewhere on the page. If you've used a lot of those open source libraries and so on, a common pattern is there's this node on the page. And you're going to say, attach a behavior to that part of the page. In this case, they'll say safely, instead of just saying attach it, now it's safely attach it to the page.
Okay.
And now the code is running in the sandbox. The other things we do, I mean, we haven't addressed this yet, but it's much more than just security. If the code fails, we keep it isolated. It will not bring down the rest of your page.
Excellent.
If the code goes into my favorite one, we'll show this one.
I'm going to show this. Yes.
Here's a really fun one. As I said, we could use any browser. Let's just fire up. We better use IE for something here. So let's fire up IE. And I'm going to do some really nasty things in my code. Equals. Pretty simple.
That's an infinite loop, Scott, right?
Yeah, we're going to do an infinite loop.
Okay.
When I clicked it, before we do the infinite loop, I realized I want to make sure you guys can see that the page isn't going to die. So set interval. We need to get something on the page to show you that the page is going to run the whole time. When I click this, there we go. Now, just to show you, notice for any of those DHTML developers, mm-hmm. I set the title. But I only modified my title, not the web page title.
Okay.
So this is, again, showing that you programmed to the DOM. But let's go back. This first one up here is the one when I click, it's going to go into an infinite loop. Well, usually what happens is at some point the browser will say something went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it will allow you to stop the code.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that model is when you stop the code, you would have stopped that clock. You shut down the page, essentially crashing the app.
The whole page, yeah.
Yeah.
Because JavaScript is single-threaded.
Correct. Yeah. We are still on that one thread. We can't turn... I wish we could, but we can't turn it into a multi-threaded environment.
Understood.
But we can synthesize multiple threads.
Excellent.
So what's going to happen here is let's go back to the screen.
Okay.
And I'm going to cancel the code. This was my prompt. If you notice, you've never seen this dialog probably built into the browser.
Mm-hmm.
When I hit cancel, it says this code was disabled by the user,
mm-hmm.
but the clock is still ticking.
Nice.
Now, my favorite one, we're not going to go through too many of these because, I mean, you could go try them out yourself. And,
sure.
But we're going to do one more because this is my favorite one. And I always do this with usually a pretty funny, sarcastic statement, but... I made a typo. Actually, that's a really good example. I made a mistake somewhere in my code.
Mm-hmm.
So when it tried to run it, the clock is still ticking, and the code just got disabled. I got to just go find out where I typoed.
So the benefit of doing that is that if you are including in your site scripts that someone else has written, and for some reason there's a mistake in those scripts, they're not going to kill your entire page.
Yeah, I just have a huge syntax error because I left my other code in there. Now we got what we want. There we go. This is one of my favorite ones. If you looked at the code, I made an infinite alert box.
ha 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 ha.
Yeah. Usually what will happen is...
And it'll just never go away.
It's going to keep laughing at you.
Yeah.
Pretty bad.
Yes.
I mean, where's that task manager, that very valuable tool?
Yeah.
What will happen here is at some point, we will come in here and say, same error. Something seems a little funky about your code.
Yes.
And give the user opportunity. Now, I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm going to say, no. Let it laugh at me a little bit longer. And at some point, again, all these are fully configurable. We're set about 10 right now.
Okay.
It will come back, and the user can now kill the code. And we keep on running.
So while you're looking at the screen, let me point out some other things there that I made an analogy with virtualization before in virtual machines. And you see that those instances for the code, actually mm-hmm. they have virtual machine-like control. So you can... pause, resume, you can clone, you can reload in case there's an error. So Scott can now reload the one with the infinite alert.
And have a laugh at me again.
And mm-hmm. then the colored square in the right bottom shows the state of the instance. So if it's green, it's running. If it's red, it's been disabled by our runtime. And sometimes if you pause it, maybe Scott would pause one of them, it's going to turn into yellow.
I'm going to show you. These are always fun. I mean, everyone's always like, show me a game. Because right now all the code we've run is kind of useless.
Yeah.
This is just a standard DHTML game. It would run. It runs just fine. Actually, let's prove it to you. Wait for my...
And again, that's not running in an iframe.
No iframe.
No iframes. Yeah.
This is the web page running directly. You'll see it runs just fine. This is no sandbox.
Yeah.
This is loading the page directly. This is the same content loading inside of another web page, no iframe.
Mm-hmm.
Fully isolated and fully secure. I'm going to quickly just start it and try to pause it. Now, what's interesting about this is this game knew nothing about pause. You asked me a great question before you say, yeah, the browser's one thread.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens if I start adding lots of games?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, no matter what we do, we're going to bog down the browser.
Sure.
By the way, again, this cloning for free. The guy that wrote the page, he built one instance of his page. This cloning is happening automatically and they're all in isolation. So what we have is the facility for us to... automatically freeze any piece of code.
Nice.
And maintaining all the state. You'll see the ball is frozen in time. I could go down here and start up my other game, pause that game, come back up here, resume this one, and so on. And these throttles, right now we have user explicit control, but again, the host can decide to define an activation model. I don't know if you're familiar with Facebook. With Facebook JS has this model where code doesn't activate till you click on it.
Hmm.
We could support that and go one step further. One of the interesting other things, using the little story, we discovered when we first did Windows Live Gadgets, what happens when something seems to go wrong.
Mm.
The poor user is put in this position where they're running around the page saying, oh, I'll remove this one. Was that the bad one? No, I'll remove the next one. We, at least now, if there's a failure, can immediately shut it down and report it. Or if the machine gets bogged down, instead of removing it till your machine comes back, you can just say pause, 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 and use the one you want.
Amazing. really incredible, you guys. This is really interesting. Now, how long have you been working on this?
I've been, arguably, I could say since 1995.
All right.
Very slowly.
Yeah. So actually quite interesting if you think about the evolution of the web, though.
Yeah.
DHTML is, I kind of call it a forms package. And it still is one, but we're built. Imagine, I'm going to show a little bit of age here, but imagine you were building your VB app and all you had was one form. If I remember, I think that's how VB started, and you had to slide everything over. That's what DHTML is.
Yeah.
And it didn't really evolve to be a full application model. But the community as it is, and the way innovation goes, it doesn't matter if the technology keeps up, we find a way to leverage it in cool ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what happened. I mean, the technology, all the technology you're seeing here is based on, could have run 13 years ago. There's really nothing here that we're doing that is unique to anything that's changed. Mm-hmm. It's just that we recognize that the scenarios have evolved.
Yes. Yeah.
And that these, what was not an issue, we at least did not really come up as a big issue before, is becoming more and more of an issue now.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because one of the things that it has enabled this sort of is the stagnant nature of JavaScript, mm-hmm. right, as a language. Now, you know, in the conversation we had, and you alluded to this, with Dave Thomas, right. Eric Meyer, and Pratap, was, you know, actually talking about the evolution of JavaScript,
right.
and the fact that it's insecure and how the web is sort of a nightmare in some sense. Let's connect the dots between what we're talking about here and exactly what was said that sort of interests you.
That's a very easy vector to understand because JavaScript hasn't really evolved a whole lot, but like Scott pointed out, what has changed are our assumptions and the way in which we use JavaScript.
Sure.
So if think back in 95 or, you know, 97, people were mostly using JavaScript for blinking tags and things like that on their web pages. Well, if you look, you know, fast forward, you know, 15 years, and you see that people are using JavaScript in very different ways, and it's become a very powerful tool in the browser to mm-hmm. power up all these mashups and all these Web 2.0 sites. So the language stayed pretty much at the same point in space, but the world around it has changed. So mm-hmm. pretty much an interesting illustration of relativity in the browser.
Absolutely.
And now that we are realizing the limits in this new context, in this new frame of reference, we are realizing and running into the limits and the things that made sense when JavaScript was merely a simple toy language that would make your buttons blink on the screen, to something that actually powers the entire mashup, the entire suite of web totally. Applications.
I mean, it's a, and you know this very, very well, given your years of expertise, it's a very, very strange language, but it's also pretty damn powerful. I mean, it's interesting. It's an interesting language.
Which is actually an interesting point, because when there was this, just so you know, what you're looking at here, the ECMA committee is looking at this, which owns the JavaScript language security. Mm-hmm. We're all working together, all the usual suspects, us, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, IBM, if I left your company off, I'm sorry, but even the Dojo guys, I think, are involved. There's a whole bunch of people involved. We recognize it's an important space. What is interesting about this is that when we look at the JavaScript language, you have these debates of, do we eliminate the bad parts, because it is such a weird language.
Yeah.
I'm of the mind of, you know, it's a weird language, but people found a way to embrace it. I mean, there's a lot of passion about how to use the language. So what we're trying to do is find a way to take those patterns that are familiar to people. Whether or not I say they're good or bad is almost irrelevant. If you think they're useful, how do we embrace it and use it?
Mm-hmm. Actually, to give credit where credit is due, there's a book about it, JavaScript Good Parts and the Bad Parts. And
no, it's all about the good parts.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
To illustrate some of the idiosyncrasies of JavaScript, if you will, maybe Scott would like to show the nature of the prototype-based language and illustrate how the sandbox accommodates modifying prototypes and the whole chain in the prototypes.
Actually, that's an interesting point. One of the big challenges, this is back to how do you combine lots of pieces of code.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big issues, again, that library developers discovered, and if you're not a library developer, this may not be familiar, but anyone that wrote one will get this immediately. All the early libraries, you go back a few years, when they first started, extended the base object prototype. So the base object that everything in JavaScript derived from, they added a member to. Now this was back to, we're talking about JavaScript's a weird language, that created every for-in loop that anyone ever wrote to get that extra member in it, which broke a lot of code.
Mm.
So instantly everyone stepped up and said, okay, there was this kind of general agreement across the industry of everyone that wrote an open source library, the object prototype is off limits. You touch that, things will break. that's great because the group of us that knew about that never did it. And then you have that one poor new developer, that guy that says, well, it's still useful, I'll do it. And next thing you know, he didn't realize he just broke everyone else. So prototype chain inheritance, while really cool, can create some very interesting problems. This is another example I will show in a few minutes. Let's just quickly move away. Let me get do exactly what Drago said. One of the things we can do is, well, let me just kill all this
get
in
rid
here.
Of all this
we'll start over. Real-time typing here. Demo 1, we'll call it. We're just going to do very simple things. I'm talking about prototypes. We have wanted to embrace things, even if people think it's kind of funky. I'm going to keep the code very simple, but you'll notice what I've done is take the built-in implementation of uppercase, put it on the date. Pretty quickly, assuming I typed that right, I'm now screaming the date at you. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say I'm kind of adverse to fully uppercase things. I actually want to make sure...
The other way around.
Thank you. I do this every time. I'm like dyslexic in this demo. But to lowercase, I will never let you scream at me.
So before you run, so what Scott's going to do now is going to fire up a new instance in the sandbox where the prototype chain is different than in the existing instance.
I realize, just so I can do this both ways, I'm going to tweak this so we can put this in an alert. We're going to run this one. I'm going to click here. You'll notice it's now lowercase, just so I could go back and forth. That's why I put it in the click. Mm-hmm. We'll run another one. This guy is uppercase. This guy's lowercase. Remember, same page.
Nice.
Your prototypes are not colliding.
Excellent.
I could extend the base object prototype. It will only impact your code. You could do those really evil things like override what an array is, and you will only override it in your code. Don't do it. Bad pattern. But if someone tried to use that as an... some people call those exploits. If they try to do it, they're only impacting themselves.
Okay. So think back to the mashup world. Think of the benefits. You're having all these bits and pieces that various people have put together, mm-hmm. and you want to build this compelling experience in your website. You can mash them up together safely, knowing that the sandbox is going to keep the things separate so that you won't have any collisions, you won't have any overrides that you don't want to happen because they're going to make your code to stop running.
Amazing. So, again, I'd like to say, how is this deployed? So, I'm a web developer. I'm Channel 9, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to use the web sandbox for any number of reasons. I want to bring in content from all over the Microsoft properties. So, what does it look like for me? You're saying I just include some JavaScript?
The goal is, right now, just so you know, we're in our early days. We pre-released this. We are
CTP.
Not...
CTP.
Yeah,
Web CTP.
Yes.
Web CTP. The whole point here is that I don't believe we're truly ready for production environments.
Okay.
Rather, this is where we want to get everyone involved who's watching this, mm-hmm. which is security is a huge problem. It would be a mistake for us to actually try to build this into the browser at this point, mm-hmm. because we'll probably make a mistake, and you know how hard it is to update browsers.
Yes.
Rather, by focusing on building JavaScript libraries that could work ubiquitously, we want to get the community involved.
Excellent.
We made a lot of decisions on what we think is right or wrong regarding security, like tag name. As far as I could tell, there's nothing insecure about reading the tag name of any element on the page. Inner HTML, obviously, you can't read inner HTML of things you didn't create. That would leak information. Now, I could be convinced that maybe tag name is potentially evil from nodes that you didn't create. I don't know. And that's a very simplistic example, but you could expand this very quickly to a lot of different problems. The other thing is we got to make sure we get it right. Part of what our website is about is we have actually set pages up there where we want you to intentionally try to break them.
Cool.
We want to get you those quality of service warnings, find a way to make your code shut down the page, find a way to read bad things. Only via those mechanisms will we reach a point where I would want Channel 9 or any site to use it. An interesting little side effect here about our team, I work for Windows Live. Dragos works for Live Labs. This project is out of the Live Labs moniker. They're taking on the funding for it.
Nice.
But we also have people involved from MSN and other organizations and Microsoft because we're recognizing this is a pretty broad problem. So we're trying to bring in our own experts, but we need the other help. But getting back to your question explicitly, eventually what you'll do is you'll have two choices. You can take that transformation component, host it yourself on your server, and manage the transformation yourself, and then just load the script library. Alternatively, you can use our servers as a proxy, or we have a client component to do the transformation, and then you just use the script. The libraries to wire it up are almost as simple as, basically, load untrusted code and attach here. That's the mechanism. The other interesting point here is that, and this is kind of fundamental, is we're showing you gadgets in the box. This model will allow us to go well beyond that box.
Sure.
Let's say you built a really cool site. You remember SMB, everyone wants to be a platform. You want to build a cool site, but the problem with it is letting them in a box or letting them touch rendering defines a contract. You really can't tweak that part of the page anymore. Let's say you just want to provide APIs but no rendering. Your site can choose to lock down the security model and say, the only thing you could call are, let's say, set map coordinates, get map coordinates, and write JavaScript. You can't manipulate the DOM. That is fully under control and can be configured by the host developer, and we have a very simple JSON-based object for defining those rules. So we're trying to build this not only to be a secure technology, but to be one that's extensible by every site developer.
Nice. Now, getting back to how you guys composed this is you showed me a bunch of JavaScript. So, you know, what did you write this in, right? So the server component is what?
The server component is right now written in C#. It can easily be translated to any of your favorite languages. It's just a bunch of AST parsers and simple things like that. Mm-hmm. The client, I wrote a Notepad in JavaScript. All right, no, maybe not Notepad. But it's basically just, it could have been. It's just pure JavaScript.
Awesome.
Perhaps some of the coolest JavaScript I think I've written in a while, but it's
right on.
Cool JavaScript nonetheless. And since it's all going to be up there, you can go look at it and tell me it's not cool or that I don't know what I'm doing. That's mm-hmm. fine.
Excellent. So call to developers, get out there and start playing with this.
Yes, so our goal here is to tackle this problem in an open fashion. So as Scott pointed out, we'd like as many pairs of eyeballs aimed at the sandbox as possible because mm-hmm. security is not something that a single person can tackle in their garage. It's something that you have the community involved and they come up with exploits and exercise different scenarios and try to break in and share their learnings about how things are happening in the real world. Mm-hmm. So we have the site out there. The site offers the ability to actually write your gadget, like Scott has shown so far. It has a set of existing applications that we have prepackaged with the site that you can try and break. Mm-hmm. And it also has interactive documentation. So all the documentation is sprinkled with code snippets that have the Run in the Sandbox button next to them. Click the button and just run the samples and see how they work, and then you can edit with them. And also you can try and cut and paste the code that you want to try in the sandbox. If you have other environments and Notepad or whatever you're using for JavaScript or for your gadget code, you can try and run it in the sandbox and the other way around.
Cool. Now, one question I would ask is, one of the things I found very cool with the work that and Yuri Dragos was involved in this with Eric Meyer, and the way he implemented threads in JavaScript was by using exceptions. Mm-hmm. What sort of thing are you doing?
Well, for the most part, it's not so much the threads that I'm trying to manage. I cannot tweak the threading model. Mm-hmm. What I am doing is controlling the execution within the single thread. So what happens is the moment in that transformation step, we intercept and augment every execution call. So when you enter your context, basically, technically what's happening under the hoods is your code got transformed inside of a functional closure. So it has its own lexical scope. When we enter that closure, we make sure we are wrapped inside of its own, basically, try-catch. So any exception that may occur will get caught by our environment before the browser. And once it's caught, we know what context it actually happened in, so we can tie it back to that context and disconnect the code. Now, the other thing that comes up is, due to the fact we're intercepting every call, let's pick something like events. Since we are intercepting everything, I manage and know every event that you sunk in the system. So if your code fails, this is how I know I could tear you down. I know all your references. I know everywhere you manipulated the DOM. I basically have a big destruction process, which basically I call kill process. Mm. So what we've basically emulated is we have one thread with, you could argue, multiple processes.
Nice.
It's kind of what we've done. And every process, while it shares a thread, will be protected. We've done some other interesting augmentation where, like, we pool timers. Anything that is asynchronous, due to the fact it's began asynchronous, we know we can maintain the callbacks in basically a prioritized queue. So if we recognize we make one asynchronous callback and it's eating things up, and the next one is occurring actually synchronously but can be an asynchronous call, we'll defer it and come back into you later to give the basically what I call let the browser breathe. Yeah. you know what I say is a lot of times the browser runs hot. What that means is you can't click on things on the screen. Our thresholds right now are somewhat high, but they're configurable. If code blocks for more than about 2 seconds, it's actually a simplistic but complex algorithm. It's a combination of time-based and statement-based. After 10,000 statements or 2.5 seconds, we will then try to interject our quality of service warning saying something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And at that point, actually, after that first threshold's crossed, that one process, the threshold tightens up, and we'll warn the user quicker the next time because we realize something seems to be fishy. But for the most part, we're trying to be as unobtrusive as possible. The whole threading model should be completely transparent. The fact that you get cloning, the fact that you get pause and resume, no one writing their code should have any concern about it. That's basically the black magic that happens underneath the hoods.
Excellent. Now, one question I would ask is,
a lot of, you know, what if I'm including a mashup that programs against a COM object, right? So an ActiveX control. What you're saying is that ActiveX control starts doing weird things, right? Because it's actually running as a native component. It's isolated, again, in the sandbox, right?
Partially, no. Actually, we will not support arbitrary ActiveX controls. And the reason is ActiveX is native code. And native code can actually do anything. Remember, I'm a security solution. Native code can go reach your hard drive. What we will do, though, is if let's say the host environment had a trusted ActiveX control that he wants to give certain APIs from that control access to the third-party code, they can build a rule that gives safe and secure access to those APIs. Flash, our current release doesn't support Flash. We have thoughts on how we're going to address it. Same thing with Silverlight, where we have thoughts on what we're going to do there. It's just not turned on yet.
Sure.
We will try to actually support iframe transclusion, so you'll be able to drop iframes and we'll secure the nested iframes and everything downstream. For those third-party libraries, which is a common pattern, we'll support dynamic loading of scripts and we'll attach them to the right context. If you know what I'm saying, it's really quite cool because it's a complex problem. How do you go get third-party code and attach it to a running process and keep it in that same isolation, knowing that there could be multi-instances?
Yep. Yes.
And keeping it all
science.
The interesting thing, which you haven't asked me, which we've also done, is we've normalized the programming model, and this is kind of cool. The other challenge web developers have is they have to deal with browser differences.
Do you want
to
show that?
Yeah, this is kind of neat. Oh, I got logged out. I'm videotaping my password.
Nope.
All right. This is kind of neat. This is IE8, and I'm just going to say it could also be IE7 or IE6 for the purposes, because I don't want to get people excited when they kind of see what this line of code does. There's a W3C event model. The original event model is an IE, which is the one they still support, which is attach-detach event. That was a model I spec'd in 95. There's a global event object. A fun story on why it's a global object for another video. But I basically created this global event object.
It's all his fault.
Years later, the W3C standardized on a slightly different API. They rightfully eliminated the global event object. The reason I did it, the time was no longer necessary for it. And they made it the first argument to every event handler. Now, IE still only supports the IE event model. One of the things that we can now do in our virtualized environment is fix API differences. So in IE, we have full support for the W3C event model, right down to the EV name, the target attribute. I should actually probably use no name here instead of tag name if I want to be more standards compliant. And the CSS method for manipulating calculated styles. IE supports current style. This is the W3C standard. When I run this, you'll notice it's not a very interesting example, but it's more to illustrate a point. All that W3C code ran in IE. Now, this isn't just about augmenting IE. IE actually has two events, and if any standards people are listening, this is everyone that has written a library found these two events useful, and I would recommend they get added to some standard. On-mouse enter and on-mouse leave as an easier way of doing hover effects. It's an IE only, I think maybe one other browser may support, but it's an IE feature. It's not part of the standard. Due to the usefulness, I elected in our sandbox to add that as a default to the policies.
Do you want to show our demo?
Which one? We
have a demo with one mouse enter, one mouse leave.
It'll take me a moment to find. I think people could get the point on that one. It's basically a hover effect. But the point there is that one of the other interesting side effects of having this sandbox is if the browser is capable of supporting a standard, we can normalize it. You can also, forget security, we can now use this virtual environment to experiment with new APIs. I could just say, you know, I don't like the way the W3C invented or created their event model. Let me just try to create my own. It maybe is better. It's just an example. But there's a lot of neat things we could do. And whatever you do, well, you can make it run in all browsers.
So that's amazing. I mean,
so by now, what I mentioned earlier about virtualization and how we're tackling security and other things like normalization across the browsers through virtualization hopefully makes sense, because by injecting this virtualization layer, we're exposing one API, maybe the W3C API, and we're working on top of a different API, for example, the iNative API. So think, you know, to draw an analogy, think the TLR. So you have IL on top and x86 at the bottom. This is the same idea here with a virtual machine.
Outstanding. It's really interesting. I mean, so it really, you know, it means I could write as a developer one chunk of JavaScript, one chunk of DHTML, I mean, JavaScript that operates on the DOM, and then it will run in all browsers.
That is our goal. Now, in reality, nothing is as simple as a statement.
Of course not.
Obviously, you should still test it. At the end of the day, I mean, it's certain areas where it can get difficult is managing rendering differences between the two browsers. Now, what's kind of neat, though, is we haven't done this, but we know we could. The box models across different versions are slightly different for CSS rendering. If I really wanted to, and it's a decision we can make, I could actually go in and make the box models completely transparent across all browsers. The point is there's no limit to how far we could take this. The limit is based on how much code you want in the virtual machine.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that really is the end objective. At minimum, we know we're raising the bar. We're, depending on your point of view, we're making the bar much easier for developers to do this. We're going to lower resistance for how you get your stuff to run cross-browser, but it doesn't eliminate the fact you still should test it.
Absolutely. This is amazing. You know, this really is very, very cool. And I'd like to thank you guys for taking time to do this.
Thank you.
People at the PDC have seen your session.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And, you know, they should watch this to...
Watch this and visit us online.
And visit you online. Actually, most importantly, play around with this stuff. Try to break it.
Absolutely.
Try to break Scott's code, man.
Yeah, please do. That's actually a good... that's not where I meant to go. I want to show you one thing, because this is important to show our philosophy.
Okay.
One of our forums is called Full Disclosure. Due to the fact that I made the comment that we are in a stage where we do not want this used in production yet, if you find an exploit, it's not emailed to a black hole. We want you to post it the moment you find it directly into our forums in real time for the world to read.
Nice.
So, and that will also allow us in real time to hopefully, well, almost real time depending where you are in the world, we'll reply and hopefully address those issues or explain what's going on. And this is a really important model because this is, as I said, a big security challenge and a big opportunity, and we want your help, and we want to make sure that we can engage the community in the best possible way. Since we haven't mentioned it, our URL is websandbox.livelabs.com, and that's the entry point. And from there, you can find our documentation, samples, and links to the forums.
Absolutely. And, of course, that link will be in the associated text for this post.
Perfect.
And awesome, you guys. This is really, really cool. I look forward to seeing how this evolves.
All right.
All right. You take care.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.